Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello, and welcome to Week to Week, the news commentary program at the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Zipperer, Vice President of Media and Editorial at the Commonwealth Club, and your host for Week to Week. I'm pleased to introduce our two panelists for today. Carly Schwartz, to my immediate right here, is the editor of the Huffington Post San Francisco, which she founded after serving as front page editor at the Huffington Post mothership, as I like to think of it, the headquarters back in New York City. Before joining Huffington Post, she ran new media efforts for California Governor Jerry Brown's recent campaign. And you can follow her work at Huffington Post on Twitter at HuffPostSF. Did I get that right?
You did.
Great. On the other end there is our returning champion, Dr. Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University, and he's a political analyst on NBC 11. And his new book is out.
Yes.
Do you have a copy of it? It's actually in print. It's called Not So Golden After All, The Rise and Fall of California, which is probably on Jerry Brown's reading list or
probably.
His staff.
Probably. Something he could have written. Can I get a signed copy afterwards?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Later in our program, we'll be bringing on stage Susan Reynolds, the longtime editor-in-chief of the Marina Times, for a deeper discussion about our San Francisco sheriffs. Let's call it a situation. Now, on to our discussion. And I wanted to start with something that we have these topics that sometimes percolate up from various parts of the country, and then they become huge, and they're not always clear why that one caught fire. Currently, we've got a new issue. It's splitting the country in half, and there seems to be no in-between on it. On February 26th, George Zimmerman, who's an armed neighborhood watch volunteer in Florida, shot and killed Trayvon Martin, an African-American teenager. That much both sides agree on, but of course, there's more. There's gun laws. There's issues of race. Larry, people get shot every day in this country. It's kind of the one thing Americans still do. Why do you think this case has really caught on? I mean, across the country.
Well, I think there's two reasons. The first is the fact that we've got issues like this, as you said, all the time. You know, and it's not just in Florida. Mm-hmm. It's all over the country. All we have to do is look at Oakland. All we have to do is name the city, name the state, and you're going to find questions about inappropriate behavior by law enforcement, particularly when it comes to people of ethnic minorities. I mean, that's just the reality. Mm-hmm. That's the first part. But the second part in this case isn't just what happened at the time; it's what happened afterwards. And like so many things, when you follow the trail, you begin to see all these inconsistencies. You begin to see that perhaps the law wasn't really executed as it should be by those in power. And, you know, when the people who we elect or we choose to serve and protect us don't do their jobs, that really augurs a credibility issue. And I think that gets us all a little worried and a little unsettled. So with that, you have the explosion. The kindling is already set anyway. You know, you have this kind of thing go off, and there you have it, a national story, a national conversation. And unfortunately, it's a conversation that we have again and again and again.
Carly, do you see much of resonance of this locally? I mean, is
there is. It has been resonating pretty mm-hmm. strongly locally. There was a big story in the Chronicle this morning about how Oakland mothers are actually kind of angry because it does happen all the time in Oakland, especially to, you know, minority children. And they feel that the Trayvon case has gotten so much national play, but their own stories are kind of sliding under the radar. There have been high-profile events. There was the Oscar Grant shooting in 2009. A lot of activists who came out for those protests when Oakland kind of exploded have been spearheading the protests in honor of Trayvon in Oakland and San Francisco. And then just this summer, a black man was killed by San Francisco police outside of a BART station, and there was a huge surge of protests around that incident, and that's kind of being reignited. His parents came out and spoke in honor of Trayvon at a recent rally. So, yeah, it is resonating around here, especially in conjunction with those specific events.
And I think that's what happens when you see something that's the Florida example. Everybody looks back to where they are, where mm-hmm. we live, and they recall, oh, my, it's happened here.
Right.
And it happens again and again. San Jose, for example, has a series of stories about the way police treat Latinos at night, on the weekends in the downtown bar areas. Clearly, all kinds of data showing that this group, you know, gets arrested more often, you know, for more things than anybody else. Well, after a while, it's not an aberration. After a while, it's what happens. And so that event in Florida, unfortunately, you know, symbolizes issues like this all across the country.
But and I think people are mad because justice isn't served so often. I mean, George Zimmerman wasn't even arrested because of that Florida loophole. And Johannes Messerli, who was the one who killed Oscar Grant in, at the BART station, got out of jail after less than 2 years. I mean, really, these kids are, quote unquote, you know, murdered at the hands of law enforcement. You can argue if, you know,
you can argue a number of things, right, on certainly the Oscar Grant case.
Right, but the bottom line is, you know, slap on the wrists.
Well, we probably shouldn't relitigate Oscar Grant, but it does kind of lead to the issue of when it does become a very hot-button emotional issue, because it's hitting, those core issues, race, protection, police identity, identifications, et cetera. Do you really ever get, if you will, the truth out of it, or then does it become basically impossible to question what happened? In other words, from the other side.
Right.
You know, last night on CNN, I want to say it was Piers Morgan, but I might be wrong. I believe it was George Zimmerman's brother who was on, and it was immediately asked, so why are you here? What is it? What case are you trying to make? And I'll admit, I happen to have a view on this that I wouldn't want to be trying to defend Zimmerman, because I think he, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's coming out about him too, just as they're trying to give more background on Trayvon Williams, Martin, excuse me, thank you. But I'm not sure, it's kind of like in the fog of war. I mean, can you really get down to the truth of what happens, or is it kind of something where you have to wait and let the sound and the fury fade away?
Well, you know, the good thing about a relatively free society is that sooner or later it comes out. It's painful waiting for it to come out, watching it come out, you know. But, you know, for example, Zimmerman complained that his nose was broken in a fight and this and that as he was, quote, defending himself. Mm-hmm. Then now there's video of him going into the police station looking just fine and dandy. Well, that's just one little piece. And over time, there'll be witnesses. Over time, most of the time, these things have a way, you know, of surfacing. It's just that why do we have to go through this kind of pain again and again and again? When are we going to get it right? When are we going to start treating people, you know, for who they are, not what they are? And you know, in a society that prides itself, at least on the surface, of equality, we've got a long way to go.
To play devil's advocate, nice sentiments, but can that ever actually be achieved? I mean, you are always talking about a country now of, what, 311 million people. Everyone basically trying very hard to do their own thing. I mean,
well, I don't know if it ever can be achieved. It'd be nice. I don't know if it can be achieved, but I think it's something you strive for.
And it takes incidents like this to kind of sober people up and remember.
Well, and where would you put, if you will, the pressure then? What does need to change on this kind of thing? Because I don't think legislators wearing hoodies in the state, you know, legislature, you know, Democrats defending, you know, liberal principles in one of the most liberal states of the country, you know, what the effect of that is, where would you actually do
something?
It's a
nice sentiment, though.
Really? I hate hoodies.
I liked the video of the hoodies. I thought
really?
It brought a little tear to my eye.
Bad style. Having nothing to do with crime. It's a bad style. Well, of course, President Obama, noted that if he had had a son, he'd look like Trayvon Martin. And Newt Gingrich called the president's words disgraceful, appalling, and Rick Santorum called them divisive. What I thought was interesting, that even the right-wing American Spectator had a problem with those two. It ran an article complaining, quote, Newt and several other conservative loudmouths have managed to make a case that had absolutely nothing at all to do with Republicans and turn it into another brouhaha where the GOP are the bad guys, unquote. That's from the American Spectator, which, you know, you might remember from the 90s was kind of the hotbed of the anti-Hillary Clinton stuff. So does it help or hurt actually trying to bring attention to this when it gets on that kind of bizarre political level during campaign season. What do you think?
Well, certainly, when Republican candidates for the highest office in the land make comments like that, it's not going to help. That's all there is to it. I mean, now, you know, the good news for them, of course, is that this story, you know, for some of us will have legs longer than for others of us. And as time goes on, other issues, the economy, what's going on in the Middle East, whatever it might be, we'll overtake it. I mean, so this has a shelf life, like any other issue, particularly a social wedge issue. But it's not likely to become a cornerstone of the election of the campaign. That doesn't mean it's not important. That doesn't mean that people shouldn't be talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick with politics then, because we are in this long march of the GOP presidential primaries. And Larry, you said actually on this stage that it's kind of a strange and depressing primary season for the Republicans, because so many of them not only dislike their candidates, they seem to hate them. And I believe this week it was reported that Rick Santorum, who's basing much of his campaign on his faith-based conservative social beliefs, he's not winning the Roman Catholic vote, even though he's a Roman Catholic. I think out of 10 out of 12 primaries where they were measuring this, he lost that vote to Mitt Romney. However, he's doing very well amongst conservative evangelicals, Protestant evangelicals. Larry, what's his problem with Catholics, or what's his magic with evangelicals?
Well, the magic with evangelicals, of course, is his stances, his Catholicism notwithstanding, his stances on, you know, whatever it might be, abortion or a number of other issues, are so tight to the right. I mean, for example, there's no reason for a woman to ever have an abortion, period. I mean, there's just no room here as far as Santorum's concerned. And the evangelicals line up with that very well. Catholics are a diverse group of people. You know, there are pro-choice Catholics. There are pro-life Catholics. There are lots of Catholics in between. I think it's a mistake, of course, to label anybody one particular niche. But the evangelicals are fairly, you know, consistent, the more evangelical you are. And so that's why he's been able to line up with that group of people very successfully. But, you know, their numbers, of course, vary depending upon where they are. He's done the best in the South, you know, where we have the highest proportion. He's going to walk into a Wisconsin.
And Romney's ahead in Wisconsin.
Right, with Romney on Tuesday. And
very
we know
the
number of evangelicals there is considerably less.
Right.
So if you use that as a measuring stick, you probably will not fare as well.
New finding also found that more voters than ever don't want to talk about religion when it comes to politics, and that includes, you know, Catholics of all shapes and sizes, whereas evangelicals really do kind of grasp the idea of having a politician that invokes God. A woman was quoted at his appearance at the Jelly Belly factory yesterday in Fairfield. I'm going to totally butcher this, but she said that she supports Santorum because he does embrace the values of God, and she reminds America that we were founded on the ideals of God. So it really
is. As opposed to those outspoken atheists like Newt Gingrich. And
exactly.
Actually, the Jelly Belly thing, I guess I didn't quite catch it until I was reading up on that. It was kind of a Ronald Reagan illusion on his part, wasn't it?
Over and over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if he has another child and it's a boy, he'll be named Ronald. I mean, that's all there is to it.
The Jelly Belly factory has those two huge portraits of Reagan that are made strictly out of jelly beans.
Okay.
And it's kind of a major homage to him.
Yeah, and the owner, of course, is a very conservative Republican, too. So it's a nice picture. It was a nice picture, and I think a good place for him to be. I think it was a smart move on his part. How many votes he gets is another story.
Well, the interesting thing about the owner, too, is that he's donated to Rick Perry.
Everybody.
He's donated to Romney. He's donated to Gingrich. He has yet to actually donate to Santorum's campaign.
It's just like all the different flavors.
Yeah.
All the different flavors of Jelly Belly.
32 flavors of GOP.
Well, of course, he was there, I believe, speaking about economic issues, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the role that the economy is playing, both in the primary as well as what it might be playing in the general election. Do you have any thoughts on kind of what's happening so far, Larry?
The rule of thumb, it's the oldest one around, is that as the economy goes up, the president's standing and goes up with it, you know, whoever it is. I think it's important to remember that when Obama was elected, we all have short memories in this business, some of us shorter than others. When Obama was elected in 2008, the economy had gone into the tank. It was a terrible few months. And of course, it didn't help that John McCain came out and said, everything's fine. Excuse me. What planet are you, to quote our friend Barney? The economy now improving, 8.3% unemployment in California. Unemployment's gone down quite a bit the last couple of months, now about 10-something. All the indicators, UCLA suggests that within a couple of years we'll be at 7% unemployment here. Nationally, it looks like we're heading under 8 before the end of the year. That's all good for the president. That's all good for the president, okay? And it takes away a big issue, you know, because now all they can say is, well, you didn't get us back to health fast enough. That's a hard one. So they've got to go to other issues. And there are plenty.
Well, and the related gas price issue is certainly one that they're trying to...
Yeah, well, the polls show so far that most people do not blame the president for the gas issue. Nor did they blame President Bush when they had a problem then. So unless something really wacky happens there, like 8, 9, I don't know, some threshold, that probably won't be an issue. But there are plenty of things that Republican candidates can move on. It's just that, in the case of the economy, it gets harder to make the case as the economy improves, because that's what people look forward to.
Well, let me actually ask you to role play. Assume you're advising Mitt Romney.
Okay.
Okay. He wants to know what he should be saying about the economy. What would you recommend he do and say to reach people, tell him that he would do, you know, let them know he has a plan that would be what? Different? It would be better? I mean, how would you advise him?
I'd go to the tax story.
Really?
I'd go to the tax issue. The fact that the economy is expanding, growing, is the best time of all now to make serious changes in our tax policy, simplify the tax structure, go to something close to a... You're asking me to...
Yeah.
Okay. Be clear, people. Okay. Get as close to a flat tax as possible. Cut down corporate taxes down to perhaps 15-18%. All these types of issues that are very comfortable for Republicans, and you build on a healthy economy. This is the time to do it. You know, as we cut down the cost of government, the growth of government, and cut down taxes. That's the way I would play it.
Carly, what are you seeing in terms of the economy and the elections? I mean, obviously, in the Bay Area, we're in a very heavily, as they say, blue area. Are other issues then kind of coming to the fore, or is that still...
Well, I think when it comes to the economy, Romney does have, or I guess taxes in general, Romney does have a large kind of following among the Silicon Valley elite, just because he does have, you know, he's kind of one of them. He had a big fundraiser with Meg Whitman this week,
That's right.
Sun Microsystems CEO was there, and the Shutterfly CEO was there, and all sorts of tech titans were there because they believe that he's going to protect their best interests. Meanwhile, he goes down to L.A., and he's greeted by hundreds of 99% protesters saying, we don't want a member of the 1%, you know, leading our country. He's out of touch with Americans. In terms of other issues, I think, obviously, everyone's following health care this week, and he was the original proponent of the Obamacare in Massachusetts,
sure.
Which is kind of where the Etch-a-Sketch comments came from. But, I don't know, I guess we'll see.
Do you have any sense of what could happen? I mean, the two parties will try to spin whatever happens, and I guess it's June when the Supreme Court is expected to issue their ruling on the health care proposal.
That's a big question. If the court declares all or part of the law unconstitutional, particularly the part where people are taxed if they do not purchase health insurance, and that seems to be the most vulnerable area and the most important, Obama's going to have his hands full. He's going to have his hands full. It's one thing to campaign against Congress. It's another thing to campaign against the Supreme Court. And he might want to, but he better not.
Because FDR tried that, didn't he?
I'm sorry?
FDR tried that when they...
Different times.
Yeah.
Very different times. Of course, he threatened to enlarge the court, right, from 9
right.
to 15, and that was a choice moment. And he was criticized severely in Congress for attempting to toy with the court.
I don't know if everyone knows what we're talking about back in when FDR was trying to institute his various New Deal proposals. He did. He tried to. Did he actually increase the number of justices, or he was proposing to? How did...
I was not alive at the time. I just want to make this clear.
I was.
Okay. This was after he was elected to his after he was reelected in 1936 by an overwhelming margin. Yeah. Congress was overwhelmingly Democratic. I mean, Republicans were an endangered species. And the court had systematically declared virtually all the New Deal legislation unconstitutional, one case after another, during that first 4 years. He said, we need to expand the size of the Supreme Court. And here's what it was very cute. He said, you know, these people, they work so hard, and they're old, and they need some help. So I propose that for every justice 70 years age old or 70 years of age or older, that we add another member of the Supreme Court just to lighten their burden up to a total of 15, six more. He had two. He had two in his corner at that time, 7-2, 7-2. Well, it doesn't take a math major to figure this one out, folks. You know, two and six make eight, and that's that. And that very threat, you know, suddenly the justices woke up the next day, you know, the glaucoma was gone, and they're seeing things entirely differently. And that same group of justices began to uphold just about all the New Deal legislation from that point on.
And now, interesting moment. There actually is a cap now on how many justices there can be.
Only by statute.
Oh, really?
Only by statute. There's no constitutional provision other than there should be a Supreme Court. There will be a Supreme Court.
Yeah.
There have been as few as six. I think there have been as many as 10 at one point. But tradition has kept the court at nine for over 100 years.
But you think it would be a bad idea for Obama to make them a political issue?
Yeah, because at the time Roosevelt did that, the nation was overwhelmingly in favor of it, you know, and he had public opinion at his back.
Mm-hmm.
The health care issue, you know, is so divisive, you know. The interesting thing is, if you ask him about Obamacare, or however else you want to call the Patient Affordability Act, people are against it. Well, what do you think about a kid's 26 and all, younger being on their parents' health insurance? Oh, good idea. What do you think about not being disallowed because of pre-existing conditions? Oh, yeah, absolutely. So people like the major elements of it, but they don't like it. So you put that together. Yeah, well, it's American politics, isn't it? So you put it together, and I don't think he wants to be campaigning against the court. It's just too divisive.
Carly, I keep returning to the fact that the Bay Area is such an unusual area politically. As far as not the presidential race, but the legislative races, the congressional races we're going to be seeing, the people who are up for election or anyone trying to get in there for the first time, what do you think the hot issues are going to be? Is it going to be whatever fallout comes from the health care? There's going to be a fallout either way.
I mean, at this point, it's anyone's guess. I mean, right now there are a really diverse group of San Francisco Republicans who are working to unseat Amiano and Mark Leno. Probably not going to happen. They're pretty supported up here. I mean, gay marriage is a big one, but everyone in the Bay Area supports it.
There was an article that I think it was on Politico.com that the congressional Republicans' leadership is basically trying to just stamp out the issue. You know, stop the amendments that are related to gay marriage, just because they're starting to see that the tide is going the other way from that.
I mean, even among conservative Catholics, they're polling in support of gay marriage now, which is why they kind of
younger evangelicals
veer towards Romney.
Yeah.
When you talk about the congressional delegation in the Bay Area, there are probably two seats that will have interesting outcomes. McNerney's new seat, the ninth, which has been moved east, you know, which has it's cost him a good deal of liberal support in the western Contra Costa area, and now he's gone into the valley, you know, that new third, I think it's the ninth district. That could be troublesome. I think if Democrats better watch out on that one. Watch out. He could lose that one. And the other interesting one is Pete Stark's district, and I think that's the 13th. But Stark, you know, has also had his district changed. He's 80 years old. He holds, some people think he's rather contemptible because he never comes home. And, of course, he's Congress's only atheist, and at least self-described. Mm-hmm. And he's got a young guy running against him, this Eric Swalwell guy, for the Democratic voice and That could be a surprise.
Interesting.
Have you been watching the Lynn Woolsey race out in Marin at all?
Well, she retired.
She retired,
of
so her seat's open.
Yeah, and there are, I forgot, 8 or 10 people running in that, and Jared Huffman seems to be the person who's got the best shot there. But don't forget, in this crazy place we call California, we have what they call the top two primary, and the top two people who get votes in any election, any primary election for Congress, legislature, whatever, will face off against each other in November, even if one person got 90% in June and the other got 10. And well, we're going to come back and do it again. You know, I mean, I can't explain it.
Makes about as much sense as ranked choice voting here in San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, this week, moving on to a new topic, the Occupy protesters, they reestablished themselves in San Francisco. I know you've been covering this, and what is it, a changed Occupy that's now back, or do they have plans for something greater? What are we likely to see?
I mean, you look at their website and you think they have plans for something greater. They have everything from general assemblies to group meditations to protests, you know, scheduled all the way up through the spring. I think it's just kind of a reduced version of the Occupy that we had at Justin Herman Plaza in the fall. They're calling themselves the Reoccupiers. They're about 10, couple dozen people at any given time sitting in front of the Federal Reserve Building now is where they are. But, you know, they're not really doing much. There was a little bout of violence earlier this week. Yeah. Two members of the group were stabbed by other, quote-unquote, Occupy members who had come in. The problem with the Occupy movement out here is that it does attract, you know, kind of more homeless people and wanderers and vagrants, because people will provide supplies to them, and then they have a tent to live in, and they have, you know, food to eat, and it kind of dilutes the message that the actual, you know, tried and true occupiers are trying to give. They have been really good about kind of joining the Trayvon Martin protests. There's a big marijuana protest next week that the occupiers are going to be marching at, but really, I'm not seeing much in terms of reviving the movement.
How would you describe maybe the if you will, the core of the movement? I mean, I've met public school teachers who marched in Oakland, and of course we know there's an anarchist element of it. I mean, is it just too polyglot to even kind of define, or is there a kind of core there if you were to describe, beside the homeless people looking for a tent?
I mean, the core that I saw at Justin Herman Plaza when I went down for my live blogging back in October was drum circle hippies,
really?
Trust fund kids who are bored and looking to have their voice heard. I think one of the magic, I mean, this is true. I had a trust fund kid staying on my couch last week who's part of the original Zuccotti Park group, and then he goes home to his parents' lovely Upper West Side apartment at the end of the night. And he was arrested on live TV, so that was exciting. But
he's a reality star now.
He's practically. I mean, his big foray. But I think kind of the magic of the Occupy movement is that there isn't one core. It's all inclusive. It's all encompassing. You can join if you're angry about anything. You can join if you're angry about taxes. You can join if you're angry about education. You can join if you're angry about, you know, pot policy in San Francisco. It just really is. It embraces you. You can join if you're an angry homeless man who's going to come stab someone. I mean, they'll accept you until you stab someone. And that's kind of the magic of Occupy, but it's also the problem with Occupy. And that's why they haven't been able to kind of purvey a cohesive message beyond the we are the 99%.
And that's the point. The message, it's like a kaleidoscope. The message changes every time you turn it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of being an outlet for change, well, what change? Change to what?
Right.
For whom? When?
Change
today,
to
tomorrow?
Everything.
Right. And so the message gets, whatever the message is, gets diluted very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The Tea Party folks are so nice that way. I mean, you know, sure, there's some overlap on a few issues, but they're much narrower. And so we can define them. We know where they're going. And their message resonates. Look at the Congress, 112th Congress, how well they did, for whatever reasons. And because of that, their voice, I think, is heard much louder than the occupiers, who are sort of viewed as almost like pests.
Larry, on our very first week-to-week program, actually, on this topic, and it came right at the end of our session, so we didn't really get to get into it, but you made a really good point about really trying to understand what is driving the people the needs for both Occupy and Tea Party? Why are they not feeling fit in, obviously, in other movements, other political parties, anything else? Have you got any thoughts to add on that?
They're the folks who feel left out. And I think this is the phenomenal thing about the political spectrum in this country. You look at the far right, you know, that the Tea Party folks, you look at the far left, if you want to put it that way, the occupiers, and in some ways they have more in common than not. Mm-hmm. You know, we put aside for a second who we think might be right, wrong, or anything else. These people feel abandoned. They feel deserted. Their expectations of what their lives would be like, you know, have fallen asunder. Mm-hmm. And so they're reaching out whatever way they can. And I think this is one of the issues about American society. And by the way, it ties back to mm-hmm. the very start of this program, the whole race issue. Mm-hmm. It has become increasingly uneven. And everybody knows it, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans know it, too. They're not Democrats, you know, complain about it a lot more. Well, that's because Democrats like to complain. But the Republicans know it, too. And they know it's not in their best interest for society to become one that's like you know, a triangle where all, so many people at the bottom and so few at the top. That's not in the Republican interest either. And they may have two different ways of solving it, Democrats mm-hmm. Republicans, but they both know the problem exists.
It's interesting you say they're not that different, because my same trust fund friend was actually an active member of the Tea Party before he decided to join Occupy. And his argument for it was that it's just really exciting, the power of community organizing. And
there
I think
go.
People get excited about the fact that their voice essentially is heard as part of a big group. Occupy is being heard. I mean, the Tea Party has been heard for yeah. years. And to leverage the power of a giant, massive group of people who all want to, you know, institute change is inspiring and exciting, regardless of whether they're viewed as pests or hippies or stabbers or crazy right-wing evangelicals.
Well, I wonder if on the Occupy side, where you're talking about this disparate group of folks with disparate interests, if you will see some outreach to, mm-hmm. you know, to them or to those portions of them by organized groups. For example, the peace protesters who are here mm-hmm. in San Francisco, they've been holding vigils, you know, ongoing for a long time. If there can be connections made, and you kind of will find Occupy, I don't want to say dissolving, but kind of separating into, okay, you join this club. Now, I don't mean mm-hmm. it in a clubby way, but you know, here's a way you can actually do something that maybe is a bit more, you know, we've got some connections to power, we can get you heard.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to actually enact any legislative change, but they're certainly having their voice heard.
Okay. Well, we are going to move on to our next portion of the program. Just a reminder to those of you listening to us online, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our week-to-week panelists today are Carly Schwartz, Dr. Larry Gersten, and Susan Reynolds. I'm your host, John Zipperer. Now, I want to bring up on stage Susan Reynolds. You'll join us, Susan. Go ahead and take the middle seat. Susan Reynolds is the longtime editor of the Marina Times here on the north side of San Francisco. Welcome to Week to Week.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been covering a local story that's gone national, and that mm-hmm. is the charges against our recently elected sheriff, mm-hmm. Ross Mercurimi, mm-hmm. in a domestic battery case. Why do you think this case has become, obviously it's absorbed us here locally, but it also has gone national, and it's not the kind of national story that San Francisco would usually be, you know, usually it would be a pot story or gay marriage, and people would say, ah, that's San Francisco.
Naked people.
Yes, exactly. This is still attracted people's attention, and there's this kind of thing does go on around the country. Tell me what you find so interesting about this.
Well, I think it's interesting on two fronts. One is the political landscape and the fact that he refuses to take responsibility and he refuses to step down, even though there was a poll where 73% of San Franciscans said they just wanted him to go away. The mayor has been very vocal. When I interviewed him in October for our cover story, he said he wanted a cohesive, not a divisive political landscape. And this, right out of the chute, he got divisive. It's been made very clear, I think, that people want him to step down. I think the other issue, of course, is domestic violence really resonates. When he made the comment that this is a private family matter, that angered domestic violence advocates all over the country. And I think that was a big mistake on his part to play it down. The other thing is that he pled guilty to falsely imprisoning a woman, and he's going to be running the jails where a huge percentage of the population are in there for similar offenses. There's a lot of substance abusers, and there's a lot of people in there for domestic violence, restraining order violations, and it's pretty hard to take him seriously as the guy who's going to stand and judge those people when, personally, I think he should be in jail himself.
The San Francisco Chronicle's Deborah J. Saunders, a columnist and a frequent panelist on this program, she wrote this week that there's a problem for Mayor Lee in this, in that he's being charged with official misconduct that took place before he took his position. And she does point out that actually by statute or whatever, that can be done. They can punish you for something beforehand, but it's kind of becomes a vague question of, well, how far back do you go? What's some of the, I guess, the balancing act or the issues that Mayor Lee has to deal with?
Well, the biggest issue he's going to have to deal with is getting this past the Board of Supervisors, getting nine of the Board of Supervisors to agree to oust him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's an issue because it's very clear that you are able to go back. And this happened. He had been elected, so this was not like, you know, oh, he hasn't even run for the office. He was the sheriff. He just hadn't been sworn in. And the other thing is, it really doesn't matter so much about that as that he's running jails. He's a sheriff running jails. And he committed an offense that many other men of lesser stature would have gone to jail for. Period.
You know, I don't think we can sort of gloss over the distinction between legality and, you know, political strife. Politically, there's all kinds of fodder here. There's no question about it. Lots to talk about and lots to judge. But the law, I think, is in the end, has to prevail over everything. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're just making law by convenience. And that's troublesome. We never know what it means. And I'm not still sure, as wrong as it may be, I'm not defending him for a second, I'm not so sure if law is or is not on his side. And I think this thing is going to go a long way through the courts, maybe the whole 4 years he's there, before it's really determined whether, in fact, the mayor and the board, the ethics commission, whoever, has the right to remove him from office because of this crime that was committed at the time it was. I just don't know if it's that simple. And again, it's hard to get into this conversation because, you know, the minute you do, so now you're Ross's best friend. No, I don't even know him. But to me, the law has to stand out over everything else.
And he's made it clear. I mean, he's defiant. He's going to do all sorts of legal gymnastics all the way up until the very end.
And that's part of my problem is, you know, if you're in public service, you're supposed to be there for the good of your people. I don't think if this goes on and on and on and on, even if it doesn't, if he doesn't step down, it's going to have a cloud over him.
Right.
As it was, the Sheriff's Deputy Association did not support him. When they did an endorsement vote, over 300 votes for Miyamoto, 2 for McAreemy. They didn't support him then. They didn't feel he deserved to be where he was. So how do you expect them now to respect him when this has happened on top of that?
Speaking of endorsements, and back in November, you endorsed a different candidate for sheriffs, mm-hmm. Chris Cunney, I believe. Mm-hmm. One of your big issues, or one of the reasons for making that, was realignment. Could you explain what that is and why it's important, not only in this case, but it's a statewide thing?
Well, nonviolent criminals are being brought back to the county jails and, you know, to make, you know, room in the crowded prison system in the state.
Yeah.
And it's actually going fairly smoothly in San Francisco, much more so than it is in other counties where, in fact, in San Jose, they're using 40% of the funds to build more prisons or jails. So, you know, here we're actually using it for rehabilitation and for education, you know, all of which I think is we're actually doing fairly well with that. But I do believe that, you know, it would have been better to have someone there who, A, had management experience, B, had police experience, and C, had experience in the jail system, none of which McAreemy had. He took a class, and now he's carrying a gun. So I don't really think he was qualified to start, so that's why I didn't endorse him. I was 2 for 3. But when I sat down with George Gascon, I asked him about, you know, domestic violence, and he said it was a huge issue that he wanted. This hadn't happened then, but right. He said it was a huge issue for him. And I take it very personally because I have a friend who was stalked by her ex-boyfriend. He came into her house when she wasn't there. He broke in. She had a restraining order. She did everything by the letter of the law. He kicked in her door while she was at work. He kicked her dog to death. They put him in jail for animal cruelty. From the jail, he has been threatening to kill her, and he just got out. And eventually, she believes, as do many people, she will end up dead. So domestic violence is a huge problem. And so to have a sheriff that's even slightly on the fringe of that subject is very, very difficult for most people to swallow, especially people like me that know someone who's been abused. And by the way, she was abused for 5 years, and we'd see the bruises, but, you know, you don't say, a lot of women don't, you know, they say, well, why isn't his wife, you know, saying what happened now? It's on video. Well, because that's really typical in domestic violence cases. They don't want to speak up. They're scared. And it may seem weird. Why don't they just run away? It's a lot more complicated than that.
What about what she said this week about how she's just angry that it's shining the spotlight on her family? Do you think that that's a symptom of being a victim of domestic abuse?
I absolutely do. Hiding it, you're embarrassed. My friend was embarrassed. Right. I think there's, you know, humiliation. There's also the fear that if you do get back with him, what's going to happen? And then there's the part of just wanting to brush it all away and believe he's going to change. You know, he's going to change.
Is he still under court order not to be near them? Or
They're in Venezuela.
Okay. Susan, you've had contact with the mayor's office about this. For a mayor like Ed Lee, who's been known as a conciliator, a manager, no drama leader, it was kind of a bold move to decide to, again, to make this a big issue and to go head-to-head potentially with the progressives possibly on the board. What does it say about him? Let's start there. As a mayor, haven't seen this aspect of
it. Right, it says he has a backbone, which I think a lot of people worry because he has. I've had many friends who worked with him in various administrations through the years that said he's just the nicest guy, but considered very quiet. Now I'd say people are going to take him a little more seriously because he's not afraid to make a big move. And I think that that's important, you know, to be able to stand up as the mayor and say, look, I'm going to do something tough here, and I'm going to try to make a change. And that's, but that's something he told me he wanted to do when I, you know, interviewed him for the cover story. He said, I want to make change in all areas of the city. So he wants to make change, and I think this showed he's willing to make big change.
That's really a good point. I mean, he has really found his voice on this issue. He was so careful in terms of, you know, calculated answers to almost any kind of policy question in San Francisco. But with this one, he's just come right out there, and he's been quite clear about when he deliberated, he thought about it.
He was very pragmatic in the beginning.
Yep. But I think that was a matter of processing. He was processing this puppy. And then he said, this is where we got to go. Very different way of acting for Ed Lee.
What do you think the impetus there is? Is it his determination that, like you were saying kind of before, the law here has to be followed and we have to figure out exactly what is going on? Or is it a dedication to standing against domestic violence? I mean, do you have some sense of
what
causes, really?
I think it's both. I think anybody who is human at all would say it's not appropriate for anyone to bruise their wife's arm to try to hold her back from going to the neighbors. It's also very inappropriate that he went to those neighbors and tried to use his power to get them not to speak up. That's another big part of this. It's not just about the domestic violence. It's about the fact that this man who's going to be sheriff tried to use his power. That's kind of scary when you're carrying a gun, you know?
Yeah.
And boiling it down to the simplest terms, I mean, as you said before, we can't have a sheriff who has committed a crime. He's the highest force of law in the city.
What do you think the ramifications are, first for Ed Lee, regardless, whatever happens, if Mercurimi gets reinstated or if he's not? I mean, what happens, how does this help or hurt or affect Ed Lee as mayor?
I don't think it affects him on a level with voters, per se, or with the people of San Francisco as much as I think it creates exactly what he told me he didn't want, which is a divisive political landscape. Because no matter whether he gets reinstated or not, there's going to be a lot of people saying he absolutely shouldn't be there, and maybe a couple saying, you know, he should be there. So it's a little bit disturbing that his first attorney said he can be a bit of a tyrant, but he's not an abuser, which, of course, right away he got a new attorney after that.
Fired by the end of the day.
Okay, well, let me actually ask all of you this. Ross Mercurimi, whether he wins or loses, does he have a political future?
I don't think he does, no.
No?
It's tough.
Yeah, I mean, he's got, you know, strong progressive values, supposedly, and progressives did love him, but I think he's toast.
Can I just say one thing about the progressive issue? Progressives are in a rock and a hard place situation now with him because they support him on so many of those issues that are progressive, but one of the biggest issues that progressives fight for is being, you know, fighting domestic violence and making sure that there's more laws and protecting women. And so it's a very hard thing for now for them to say, well, I totally support his marijuana stance, and I really support, well, I can't support that. So they're really between a rock and a hard place. They can't really come out and support him for the issues they so believe in, because they're so against what he stands for and what he's being accused of.
Larry, do you think he has a political future?
You know, Americans, San Franciscans included, are very forgiving of people when they express contrition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he gets to that point where he's, and I, as I said earlier, I've got concerns about the way to go about this, but that notwithstanding, if he comes out and says, you know what, I've thought about this, I really did make a mistake, I didn't act appropriately, I need to take some courses in anger management or whatever it might be, you know, and I need to be a better person, count on me doing that from this point forward, I think opposition would melt. They'd melt, you know. I mean, assuming he meant it. But the longer he puts out his hand and says, you know, this is a private issue, much ado over nothing, all the other things, that will stoke the flames, and that will definitely jeopardize his political career, no question.
I just think he's embarrassing himself at this point. I mean, people are sick of his defiance.
I've been a long-time critic of his. In 2006, I wrote an editor's note called The Thugs Who Run Hate Street, because I lived right a block off of Hate Street for a decade. And I watched when Gonzalez was in office, it started to go downhill. But then I noticed when McGreevy got in office, it just got worse and worse and worse. And this was not for the lack of everyone telling him it was getting worse and worse and worse. Shootings, stabbings, and, you know, people that no longer are hippies, they've got criminal records. He was well aware. His office was flooded with calls. Nothing was done until people like me in the press started speaking out. And then he started saying, oh, I'm involved, I'm trying to solve this situation. But I've been a long-time critic. I think he was a terrible supervisor, and I think that, you know, this is just another nick in his political armor.
Taking into consideration the fact that you're not a fan already, but...
you think?
What can a supervisor do in situations like that? I mean, are they able to direct resources, or do they just highlight stuff and hope the police, for example...
They need to fight for their district. That's what they're there for, you know. They need to get out there and try to drive police dollars. Same thing in the Western Addition. I mean, drive-by shootings. I saw him on the news once after a drive-by shooting where a little girl was shot by two thugs outside her window, 16 and 14 they were, and she almost got killed. And he was standing up there. He said, before he said a word, he said, well, we need to find out what the reason is why they did this. We need to get them education. And, you know, we can't just throw them in jail. Well, that really wasn't the subject at the time. That really, it was the fact this little girl almost lost her life to these two thugs. Mm-hmm. Not that they needed, you know, education. I'm not saying they don't need some rehabilitation and education, but at the time, that was not really the thing that we should have been discussing. It was the problems in the Western Addition are rampant. And they still are.
I will say, as a fellow Hate Street resident, I was kind of a fan of him when he was my supervisor. I mean, maybe it's because he...
How long did you live there?
I lived there for a couple months. I mean, like I told you in the green room, you know, I wasn't, you know, tripping over thugs in 2006 or whatever. But, you know, he charmed the pants off me when I met him in the panhandle. He's out there every day meeting constituents. I feel very safe walking home at night, you know, at 3 a.m. down Hate Street.
But you do?
I do.
Wow.
I mean, I will happily say I do it all the time, and I'm a pretty careful person when it comes to... that. But, you know, I mean, I don't have a handle on the nuances of what was going on in the district before I moved there. And that's, you know, that's strictly an emotional comment, because he shook my hand and looked in my eye and charmed me. But, you know, I mean, I agree with
you.
See,
I don't fall for that stuff.
She's a tougher cookie
I'm tough.
Than me.
And the politicians here know it. They can talk to me until they're blue in the face. And if I think they're wrong, they can take me to lunch, and I'm still going to write what I believe in. And I think that what he's done is wrong. And he needs to admit it. And I think also he needs to step aside just so we can go on. The city has a big job with this realignment. And he's really just become, like you said, he's just become a sort of an embarrassment at this point.
Well, what do you folks think? Anyone want to take the microphone? I don't know if you're San Francisco residents or from outside. Judy, there's a microphone right over here on the aisle.
Hi. I guess I don't disagree with any of the stuff about the arrogance of McReaney. But throughout this whole thing, I've been bothered by how his wife has been bullied. And I think she's been bullied by the media and by the domestic violence activists. I don't think anybody cares how she feels or what she wants to do. Any comment?
I agree with you. I wrote a blog about this when it all first went down, and my big thing was the whole thing. I mean, I know that it's a public issue, and it isn't behind closed doors when you take office, but the whole thing just makes me feel kind of dirty. I mean, I don't need to hear the ins and outs of their personal, you know, arguments, and I hate reading about how she was, you know, quote unquote denied food. I agree. I mean, she seems like a very nice lady.
Well, but the problem, of course, is that we live in a society that, you know, makes Jersey Shore the number one show in America. So we like to see all that kind of crazy stuff and people doing bad things. And so I don't know, you know, I mean, it...
But Snooki loves being on the Jersey Shore. Eliana Lopez loved being on telenovelas, but she didn't want her own life to be turned into one.
Yeah. She's married to a politician.
Yeah. And she also went to a neighbor and was videotaped and she texted, and that made it a public issue at that point.
What do you think?
And so then she lost any choice on what to do with that or what she wanted to do with her husband. Everybody just presumed that she had been battered in the worst way, and therefore they had to take over her life, and that feels bad to me.
You know, this is an interesting point. At what point does the state have the right to act in someone's behalf if that person refuses to do so? Mm-hmm. It's a very delicate issue. And I'm not about to tell you that this was handled appropriately or inappropriately. But your point is a good one, because we know, for example, when children, you know, are in unsafe homes, forget about abuse, it's dirty, whatever, the state acts on their behalf. We know that when people walk around and are in some ways harming themselves, the state acts on our behalf. Was this the point? I don't know. But there is a point. We know that. We know that there is a point. Whether this is the right time, right, I think is another thing altogether.
And, I mean, what about their 2-year-old son? No one mentions him. I mean, he didn't ask for any of this.
We live in a world where, in America, every day 3 to 5 children are killed by their biological parents, every day. And it's an epidemic. Abuse of children and women is an epidemic. Homicide is the number one cause of death for women of childbearing age by their spouse or significant other. So it's a very big issue, and I agree with you. If she wants to go back with him, then she should be able to go back, and that's we live in a free world, and I've had friends who have gone back, and it hasn't been so good for them. And so I think it's her, but it's her choice. I've had friends who have said, I'm going back, and I say, okay, go back. What are you going to do?
It's just that it's not so black and white that everybody's all right on one side and everybody's all wrong on the other. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Jean. Yes.
Well, I'm very, very distressed, and I'm so appreciative that you would be so forthright, each and every one of you. But I have to ask you, I'm a retired teacher, 33 wonderful years.
My dad, too.
Well, thank you. And, of course, believe me, I saw a lot with families, and it was very distressing as well. What qualifications professionally does Ross Mercurimi have to hold any position in law enforcement? Do you know?
You said he took a class. You weren't joking.
No, he took a class.
That's it. That's it,
well,
right?
In fairness, if you look at almost any elected position, are you old enough? Okay, you want to be president? Are you 35 years of age or older? Have you lived in this country for 14 years or more? Were you born here? Well, you know as well as I do, a lot of Nimrods who fit that, right? And by golly, they can be president. I mean, and this is not to disparage Ronald Reagan. When he ran for governor, you know, in 1966, someone said, "What qualifications do you have?" And he said, "I don't know. I've been a." The head of the Screen Actors Guild. I've been a chief executive. I know you're head of that. You're head of the state. What's the difference? A few more people. So it turned out, by the way, that once he was elected governor and served 2 years and ran for president, whatever one wants to say about him politically, it's hard to say he was not a competent president. So you don't necessarily, there aren't all these rules that say you don't have to be an attorney to be a judge, a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's right.
That is shocking, too. No, my concern is just as we would look at, for example, engineers or physicians and what they have to have as far as professional knowledge, and certainly the morale of the sheriff's department and good policing, I am concerned about the personnel in the sheriff's department because I personally feel they deserve to have someone they respect and trust professionally.
They need to have that.
I feel that should be a requirement. So that's my position, Professor, but I appreciate what you've interjected here. But I think professional knowledge, certainly in specific instances, has its place. I think it should be a prerequisite. That's my position.
And just to carry this a bit more, I think this, you know, we're real good at foisting all the issues and the responsibilities off to somebody else. I'm sorry. There's a point where we, the voters, mm-hmm. have our say.
That's right.
We, the voters, make up our minds as to who is the most qualified, dependent upon what we know. And so if we don't do our due diligence in some respects, we have ourselves to blame.
Mm-hmm. That is the best point to make on that. Absolutely. I was shocked that he was elected sheriff with, the two other people had so much more experience than he did. And obviously when 300, people, over 300 people in the sheriff's deputies union don't endorse you, and two people endorsed, you would think that the voters would have paid a little attention to that, but they didn't.
Well, what do we think of Vicki Hennessey, the new one who was appointed?
Well, she's strong. She's got
she's
a long...
First woman sheriff in history, yeah. Which is...
She's
in San Francisco.
In San Francisco.
We have
not
Lori
history, not
in history of the Santa Clara County. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
She was the first one, actually.
Okay. Thank you.
I just want to say something about Ross's credentials. He was an investigator with the district attorney's office for 7 years. Then he went to the police academy. This was when Terrence Hallinan was DA. He wanted all the investigators to have some police experience. So he went and finished the police academy. He was elected president of his class. And then he was 8 years as a supervisor, dealing with difficult things. I mean, everything from the Bay, he was on committees that dealt with the whole region, the Bay Area region. He was on budget, on everything. I mean, he thoroughly knew in 8 years. He was a very bright guy. He is a very bright guy. And I've seen him take public comment for hours and hours and hours and be the only one sitting there, the only supervisor. Now, 8 years of that every day reading legislation, that's quite impressive credentials. Now, as far as the sheriff's office, it was a window of opportunity for him. Mm-hmm. He was unpopular with the police because, and I have to correct you, sorry, Ms. Reynolds, he did put a tremendous amount of energy into police enforcement in Western Addition. He did ignore the hate. I've lived in the hate for many, many years, I know, because of Calvin Welsh and the Hank constituency. He let that be. But Western Addition got all of his attention, and he came into friction with the police department because he wanted more beat cops in the Western Addition, and they resisted that. And for what it's worth, I just wanted to add.
That's actually good background. You mentioned it was a kind of an opportunity for the sheriff's office when that came up. Do you think he would have preferred a different office? Do you think he saw himself as a future mayor? Or?
Oh, sure. He's politically...
Like
to have stayed a supervisor. He got termed out, and he had to run for an office, and that was open, and he thought, I have a shot at that one.
That was open, and he did have the police and investigative background.
Okay, thank you.
It's interesting you say about the Western Addition, because that one of the worst corners in the Western Addition, the Northern Station, is right there, big, big brick building. I always said if I could be queen of the city, I would make the designer who designed the Apple stores design the Northern Station as a big bulletproof glass building so they could see what's going on out there. It's amazing. I mean, you go through the McDonald's drive-thru to get an iced tea and you see three drug deals. I've seen guns. I mean, it's crazy, and I just don't understand. The police station is right there, and it goes on right there. I don't understand it. No windows.
Yeah. One thing that has been bothering me all through reading about this, and I didn't, I don't know anything much about the man except what I've read recently. I gather he's a workaholic. I think he must be very arrogant. But on the other hand, his entire life is on the line. So, everybody... As far as I know, this came out that his wife had this video made of a bruised arm. They had a quarrel. And everybody seems to have jumped to the conclusion that he had a history of hitting her and battering her. And I don't know that anybody knows that or anybody has ever been asked. All of a sudden, it's been this big brouhaha about domestic violence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know that anybody has gone any further into the past to find out.
Yes, now, she has said that he had abused her before, and also his ex-girlfriend was about to testify, which is why they settled. She was scheduled to come and testify the next day that he abused her numerous times, and then that's when he decided that he wanted to just plead guilty to the misdemeanor.
Okay, the one other thing that I've got to say is I'm a little bit disappointed in the Commonwealth Club in that I feel that you have invited a person to your forum that, to my mind, is definitely not objective to speak on this. And to me, this should be, the media is supposed to be somewhat objective in presenting facts and figures. And I don't think that Ms. Reynolds is.
I don't think any of us here are objective about a lot of the things we've talked about today. I've made it very clear. He's read my columns. For a long time, I've been an outspoken critic of Ross McReamy's. And I think I'm a woman and I'm human as well as a journalist. And I am also an editor, so I write opinion pieces. And my opinion is that this is divisive for the city, and it's not doing our city government any good to have someone standing up there day after day after day taking away from what is really important in the city, which is that we're in a heck of a mess in the city with our budget and everything else, and it's just everything is being taken up by all of this politics with him. I just think that it comes a point where you have to cut your losses and say, maybe I should do what's best for the city and move on.
Did you start as an objective observer of him?
Absolutely, absolutely. I interviewed him, and I lived in the hate, you see, and so I have a very different view of his politics and how he handles things. And I saw the hate go down the tubes. I saw a person get stabbed in the panhandle. I mean, I've seen some things that just, you know, make me. And also, I just think that the whole issue of domestic violence, it's hard to be really. I mean, can you really be objective about domestic violence ever? I don't think you can. I don't care who you are.
But it certainly is that crucial. As has been pointed out, every life there has been affected.
Absolutely.
You know, changed. So,
as it is in every domestic violence case, it's just not played out usually in front of
it. And it may not be something any of us really gets, you know, all of those answers to, you know, what the history is and all that stuff, until maybe even after the public attention kind of moves on to something else. And like you mentioned before, truth kind of comes out working slowly, much more slowly than we would like.
And frankly, as a journalist, I'm not sure, and this is no offense to you, but I'm not sure which journalist would be my choice, would be someone who's looking at the situation and having a strong opinion based on what they see, or someone who says that they are charmed by someone's smile and like them because of that. I mean,
I never said that he, you know, my political opinion was.
You said that he won you over. You said he won you over, and I don't think that there's any place.
But actually, I think that probably does address how he had a popularity. I'm talking about him being a workhorse.
He was a magnetic dude. I mean,
yeah, and it will
speak
see
truth
he,
to power.
I think we can get one more question in here before we.
Yes, I'd like to zoom out if I could and talk more of a issue national in scope, and that
Thank
is
you.
Just get the consensus of the panel. I happened to watch Charlie Rose last night, and they had Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson on. And it was one of the most captivating conversations. I mean, those two guys, in my humble opinion, get the award for being straight shooters and talking about some tough medicine that we have to take to get on the right track on a economic viability level in this country. What that said, what they postulate is very politically unpopular, and it seems like everybody's running away from it with a 10-foot pole, but they don't seem to be giving up. I'm just asking the panel if you feel that there's any hope for our perhaps dysfunctional D.C. government starting to make some necessary but very very difficult moves that would fall under the category of taking the tough medicine.
Thank you. Larry, do you want to?
I think there is hope. I'm a half full kind of guy anyway when it comes to the glass. I think there is hope, and I think we're going to see some change after this election. Let's not forget that the election of 2010 was an aberration for a lot of reasons, and not enough time to talk about it. But the fact of the matter is, the Congress is going to change somewhat after this election, and a lot of the edges are going to go away. And with that, I think the President and Congress, no matter who's in charge, will come to some tough decisions. It's all about a balance, about taxes and spending. How much spending do you cut? How much taxes do you raise? And from whom? In what proportions? And I think you're going to see some movement on that in 2013.
Larry, can I ask you a question? What do you think about the whole thing with big oil and the tax situation and the loopholes? And
you're referring to Barack Obama calling for.
When you have five of the largest oil companies make $1 trillion in profits over the last decade, that's trillion. And you're looking for revenues, you know, it's hard to imagine that at some point you can't go to them. Just like in California, we're looking for revenues, and we're the only oil-producing state that doesn't tax oil out of the ground. 23 states, but no, California, we have plenty of money. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, let's leave that there, and let's quickly do our news quiz before we wrap up for the day. So if you know the answer, raise your hand, and when I point to you, shout it out. The first question, GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney was slapped down this week by what foreign leader? Did anyone see that happen? I'll give you a hint. He was defending Barack Obama.
Medvedev,
that's right. It had to do with Barack Obama's open mic comments about having more flexibility with Congress, in fact, after the election. Question number two, British Prime Minister David Cameron, a member of the Conservative Party of the UK, I believe probably their leader, recently visited Washington and was feted by the White House. Whom did he not meet with during this trip? He didn't meet me either. He didn't meet with conservatives. He didn't meet with Republicans. Of course, in Britain, it's the conservative prime minister who's leading the charge, for example, for legalizing gay marriage, which is not a view shared by most conservatives in the U.S., nor by President Obama, so I guess Cameron did meet with a conservative after all.
Did you read the menu for what they ate that night?
No,
it was like pickled boar stew or something ridiculous.
Third question. U.S. Representative Bobby Rush was forced off the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives this week. Why?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. He was wearing a hoodie, and wearing hats is against House dress code. Number four. Tonight, people across the country, you're all going to know this one, people across the country will be eagerly looking to see if they won something very big. What is it and how much is it? Do you know?
Oh, the lottery. That's,
mm-hmm. It's actually more than that.
$640 million.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it $640 million now?
Wow.
Yeah.
Last I saw was
$553. Boy, am I going to be rich. Oh, I'm sorry.
What was it? They sold something like 100 million tickets yesterday or something? Or 100...
Wow. I saw they had a numbers crunching person on the news, I think, on your station. And he said the way to win is there's 170 million combinations. So if you got 170 million friends to play with you, you would win the lottery.
Perfect.
Let's form a club.
It's kind of the only economic stimulus package that Democrats and Republicans agree on. Okay, question number five. In a report this week by the Fair Labor Association, a watchdog group, more than 60% of the workers at what high-tech company in China say that their wages fall short of their basic needs? Yes, ma'am.
Good job.
That's right. Foxconn, of course, makes tons of Apple and other high-tech.
40% of all electronics
right.
in the country.
Apple itself, in fact, hired this watchdog group, and it apparently is standing behind the report. So
mm-hmm, they are.
Okay. Final question, and there is a prize for this question.
Okay. This is
lunch.
A bonus round.
Dun,
not
dun,
quite.
It's a sandwich.
Vice President Joe Biden, arguably one of the smarter people in Washington, but he does have a way of saying things that are goofy at best and gaffes at worst. What did he call the president of Scott Community College? Raise your hand if you know. Anybody? Anybody? Let me, he might want to cut back on the caffeine. Maybe this will do it. Her name was Dr. Teresa Paper. Am I going to have to go home with a prize? I think, Larry, you're going to have to tell us and you get the prize.
Chancellor Pepper.
Dr. Pepper, in fact.
What?
Yes, he
no.
called Dr. Paper Dr. Pepper. So your
There's
prize
Dr. Pepper in there?
Is Dr. Pepper.
Ah.
Well, everybody, thank you very much for joining us today. We'll be back here on April 13th and on April 27th. And please have a good weekend. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you both.